Roll down tide.
From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, this is the Beer Garden presented by Oxford Crystal.
I'd like to hear a little bit more conviction in your take, though. There was a lot of maybes, a lot of what ifs, a lot of questions. You need to just get on here. You need to fire and put me in a position where I have to tell you that you're wrong.
And now, here's your host, Neil McCready.
Nice. Nice.
Welcome to another edition of the Oxford Crystal Beer Garden. I'm your host, Neil McCready. Today on the show, kind of an interesting show because we're going to talk to Brian Scott Rippey. You probably know Brian from his work on OleMissSports.com. You probably follow him on Twitter at BS Rippey. He is in Cincinnati doing an internship this summer covering the Cincinnati Reds. So I talked to Brian. We talked about Ole Miss's baseball postseason disappointment. Asked about his thoughts on what happened, why it happened, how it could be prevented from happening again. Brian has an interesting perspective because he covered the team intimately up until about a month ago. And then he left for his internship. And then he was just sort of left to watch it unfold on television or whatnot. So we talked about that. And then we talk about the Cincinnati Reds, some Major League Baseball topics now that he's He's covering the Reds there in Cincy. We talk about the National League Central, the Joey Votto contract in Cincinnati, his thoughts on the Shohei Ohtani injury, what that means for baseball, a number of kind of topics there, just a discussion. And then we finish up by talking some Ole Miss football. He'll be back in August for his second season on the Ole Miss beat, covering Ole Miss football for OleMissSports.com. So we talked about some football. Still a little ways to go before you can really dive into to preseason football stuff. But we talked about that. So a lot of topics. We'll get to that in just a minute. First, let me tell you about the Oxford Crystal. It's Highway 6 West in Oxford, right next door to the Oxford Exxon. They've got the meal deals going on, the $2 meal deal, $3 meal deal, $4 meal deal there at Oxford Crystal. It's hot outside. Go grab the Fruit Punch Slushy. It's made with Sprite. It's very refreshing, a wonderful way to cool off after a hot day. And to start off a hot day, get the Sunriser Combo. It's $3.99. You get the two biscuits with sausage and egg, a beverage of your choice, coffee, orange juice, whatnot, and as well as hash browns there at the Oxford Crystal. We're coming to you from the Clark Ford Studios. Clark Ford is in Amory, Mississippi. 662-257-1900 is the number. Call that number. Ask for Corey Clark. Tell Corey what new Ford you are looking for. He'll send you a quote within 15 minutes. You know the drill. You tell him what you want. He'll give you a quote. And then it's up to you. You can shop that quote around, or you can go ahead and let Corey and the people at Clark Ford do for you what they've done for so many other podcast listeners, self-included, and that's take the hassle out of the everyday car buying experience. So simple. You get a great product. Great service after the sale, really remarkable service after the sale. It's a difference maker in terms of your automotive experience. And we'll make it even better. Tell Corey that you heard about Clark Ford on the Oxford Crystal Beer Garden. It's $500 off your bottom line from Clark Ford and Amory, 662-257-1900. We're also brought to you by Community Mortgage. It's located in Oxford, Memphis, DeSoto County, and Chattanooga. It's 30 years old this year. It's one of the oldest mortgage companies in the Southeast. All of the underwriting and the processing is done in Memphis, so you're getting local underwriting that understands your market. It's the leader in condo financing in the Oxford market. So call Jason Lowe. Ask about Community Mortgage's float-down option, which allows you to lock in the current rate. But if rates go down before you close, you can get the lower rate. It's J-Lowe, J-L-O-W-E, at CommunityMTG.com. We're also brought to you in part by Strategic Partners in Media. SPM is a full-service advertising agency. It works with businesses of all types, big or small, Fortune 500 companies to startups. SPM can help your advertising needs for TV, radio, print, and every facet of social and digital media. Look, here's why SPM is really good. It's different than all the other ad firms. They handle everything in-house. They don't sub their work out. The writing, the production, the editing is done solely by their staff. And it's crafted uniquely for their clients. Lastly, an Ole Miss grad and a Mississippian is a partner in the firm. So give them a call. See how great they are. It's Austin at strategicpartnersmedia.com. And we're brought to you by Captain John Fryer and Tuna Chaser Charters in Biloxi. John handles inshore and offshore fishing expeditions from 4 to 12 hours. He knows where to put you on the fish that you want to catch. A popular trip for visitors that don't have as much time is the inshore trips for speckled trout and triple tail, sometimes called blackfish. You can reach John through his website, tunachasacharters.com, T-U-N-A-C-H-A-S-A, charters.com, his Facebook page, or you can call John, 228-348-7817. Now let's go to our interview with Brian Scott Rippey. Again, some Ole Miss baseball, some Major League Baseball, and then we finish up with some Ole Miss football, about a 40-something minute conversation. I think you will enjoy it. Take a listen. Brian, thanks so much for joining us. I know you've been away from Oxford for, what, about a month now? Maybe a little more than a month up in Cincinnati. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. Yeah, so I'm right at about the month mark. I came up here the 15th and then started the 18th of May. And so, yeah, it's right around the month, and it's going well so far. It's been a pretty big learning experience, I would say. But, you know, it's been a lot of fun, and I've enjoyed it so far.
All right, we're going to get to the Reds and some Major League Baseball topics and such in a moment. And I'm going to get some of your thoughts on Cincinnati, since I'm coming up there, and as we tape this in about 10 days. I'm going to get your thoughts on Ole Miss baseball. I know you covered this team from preseason all the way through a month ago. So you saw the overwhelming bulk of the season. I'm sure that even though you were busy, you at least had an eye or sorts on what happened in the postseason. Are you surprised that this team had the kind of Monday that it had a week ago to end their season?
Yes, I was. I think because of the way it happened, more so than anything. Now, admittedly, I didn't get to watch any of the first game Monday. I caught most of the Sunday game and the last four or five innings of the second game on Monday. And it was just surprising to me because of the way that it happened, because the offense had been so good all year. And then, you know, all of a sudden two kids from the Ohio Valley with, you know, five plus ERAs they five shutout innings in each of those Monday games. That was just the way it went down, I guess, was surprising to me. So I would have to say, yes, I was definitely surprised.
There's a lot of people that want to put out blame and that kind of thing for what happened and the fact that this is sort of a perennial thing, that this team gets to the postseason and at least the last few years since Omaha, they're now 2-6 in the postseason since they went to the College World Series. People want to pin it on Mike Bianco. They want to pin it on a team that gets tight, that kind of thing. You're around them. Did you see signs that this was a tight team, or do you think it was just a bad day?
I think it could be a combination of both, because when I was around them, I didn't necessarily get a sense of them being tight, because, you know, unlike some past years, you know, really any time they hit any sort of adversity or had a really bad game, they bounce back in a pretty big way. You know, whether it be the next game or the next series or whatever it is, they never let it snowball and let it, you know, really get their backs up against the wall. But I mean, with the postseason history, I mean, things are a lot different in June baseball when there aren't a lot more tomorrows. So whether they were tight then, obviously I wasn't around, so I can't really say, but it definitely, like, during the regular season, I didn't really get that vibe a lot. I mean, things were going well for them for the most part. They didn't face a ton of adversity. They were playing good baseball for the majority of the year. Things that didn't really seem tight, but, you know, obviously, like I said, when you get into a postseason situation where you don't have as much leeway, that can obviously change, especially when you're kind of the overwhelming favorite like they were. Like, I don't think anybody looked at that regional and thought, you know, anyone else would come out of it really except Ole Miss. Granted, Tennessee Tech was a pretty good ball club that could hit a lot. I actually had to cover them a little bit when I interned at D1 last year. And I knew a couple of the names that I knew they could really hit. I didn't know a ton about them, but it seems like that offense was as good as advertised.
You're around the program. You're around people. As we tape this on Monday, Mississippi State's in the College World Series. We don't know who else is in. As we tape this, when you hear this, obviously everyone will know the field. But I don't have the power of looking into a crystal ball. I wish I did. That would be really cool. you're around that Ole Miss program. The fact that State made the College World Series, I know it's tempting for them to say that will have no impact on how they run things, on what they do. In your opinion, does that ratchet up some pressure around that program to get back to Omaha even more than there is internally to get there?
I think so, and I think that's only really natural, right? I mean, when you have, you know, two good programs in baseball over the last 15, 20 years or whatever it is, you know, and they're that close together, when another one is having success, and in this case, really in a year where you didn't think that that level of success was nearly possible. I read something the other day where after State lost to LSU, they were like 2-7 or 2-8 in league play and 14-15 on the year. And so just to go from that to, you know, where they're at, and credit to them, obviously, I think it's fair to say that was fairly surprising. So, yeah, I think it does naturally. I mean, I don't think there's much way to prevent that when someone that close to you and you're kind of sometimes recruiting the same kids and stuff like that, when they have that level of success, I think it does just kind of naturally ratchet up the pressure a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think they get enough credit, State, for what they did. I don't, you know, they saved their season against Ole Miss, against Florida, against Arkansas. Three top teams all season long. That's how they saved their season. They go down to a regional. They're a strike away from being finished. They lose the first game by 10 runs. They're the next day a strike away from being done, and they climb out of the loser's bracket, and now they're in Omaha. And sometimes this is what I say to people, and maybe I'm crazy. I always quote my friend Dan Jennings, who's a Major League Baseball guy, who just says, make the tournament. Just find a way. He's a, you know, make the tournament, and anything can happen once you make the tournament. And for whatever reason, they are a team and a program that they find a way to make the tournament, and then in the tournament, they sort of make magic happen at times. And you have to tip your hat to them. I don't know whether that's because there's a different structure inside their program with the way that they relax or have fun or whatever. I don't know. I have no idea. I just noticed that they seem to, this year, especially after the walk-off home run, they just played with an edge after that they still have as we tape this, that I saw it from Ole Miss and Hoover when I was covering that. I didn't see it from Ole Miss and the regional. They appeared to be a little tighter, and I don't know whether that's because they ran into good teams or it's because they got tight. And it's one of those things, and you know this because you cover a lot of baseball, I don't think we'll ever really know unless someone inside that program steps up and says, yeah, here's exactly what happened. And even then, there would be more to it than that. So I think it's one of those things we'll just never really know the answer to.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And as far as credit goes, I mean, the job Gary Henderson did amongst those circumstances, and especially the last couple weeks where the way he managed the pitching and things like that was really just phenomenal. But like you said, the goal should be I read something a while back that really kind of stuck with me, that, you know, it was a college baseball guy. I can't remember who it was, but he was like, your goal as a consistently good program is just to make a super, because in when your season comes down to two out of three games, I mean, there's a little bit of a crapshoot element to it. So, I mean, if you're getting to regionals and supers consistently, I would agree with you. I think that's really all you can ask for, wouldn't you say? Because, I mean, from there, it does take a lot of luck.
Yeah, it's like an NBA thing where an NBA team that's the underdog in a series says, hey, if we can just get this thing to game six, get it to game seven, it's, you know, becomes a little bit of a crapshoot. If you're in a college basketball game in the tournament, what is a 15 seed saying about a 2-15 game? They're saying, if we can just get to the final 4 minutes competitive, if we can just be in it in the final 4 minutes and shorten it to a 4 minute game, anything can happen. And I think it's like that in a short series. And that's essentially what Ole Miss and Tennessee Tech played. They played a 3-game series, and Ole Miss won the first game, and MacArthur was not good. Frankly, he was bad in game two, and that changed the tone of it a little bit. And game three, I thought both teams were a little tight. Both teams were playing a little bit not to lose, and then they got a big hit and had a couple of big strikeouts, and it's a short game at that point, and they found a way to win it.
And if I'm not mistaken, there was a bases loaded situation, or maybe they had a couple on in the fifth.
Yeah,
or something.
Ole Miss was up 2-0, and they loaded the bases in the fifth with one out, up 2-0, and Tennessee Tech brought in their ace, T. to kind of get out of the inning. He had two big strikeouts. I can't remember who he struck out. Cockrell and Rowe, maybe. I can't remember. But that was obviously a huge moment because if someone hits a ball, a base hit into center field, it's 4-0. And at that point, the game starts to get away from Tennessee Tech. And it didn't happen. And then they turned around the top of the next inning and hit a two-run home run. And momentum was theirs the rest of the way. And that people hate this explanation, but sometimes that's baseball.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think, especially in the college sense, where you get kind of more of a football mentality, sometimes people really do hate that phrase, but it's the truth. It just kind of happens that way sometimes.
All right, let's switch to your current gig. I know you'll be back in Oxford in August in time for football season and stuff. We might touch on that in a minute, get some early thoughts from you. But I want to talk about the Reds and what it's like for you. You've been – you're a young guy. You've moved around. You're an up-and-coming journalist. But you covered a lot of college game at Ole Miss with basketball, baseball, football. Now you're covering in a Major League Baseball setting where, from a media standpoint, it's – from my very, very limited experience, it's a completely different access setup. What's it been like for you in terms of adjusting to suddenly having real access to the people that you cover?
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's been eye-opening, I think would be a good word for it, because like you said, the access is so much different and so much more. And one of the things they told us before we started, it was on like a conference call in April, was to take note of kind of the media, like clubhouse type culture, because there's a very distinct culture. Like nobody could really put their finger on it, but like versus how you act, how to kind of go about things. And there was a lot of truth to that. It kind of took me a while. I mean, it took me the first week or so to kind of understand how things work and things like that. But I mean, I guess from a day by day perspective, basically an average day is, it's usually a 7:10 first pitch. You get there 2:45-ish. Make sure, like, you know, no news has happened or nothing, no roster moves or anything like that. Then you get into clubhouse, opens at 3:20. It's open for like an hour or so, and then you usually get the manager before the game, and then you kind of do some notes before that. And then really you're just filing pregame notebook stuff and just kind of hanging out. And then obviously the game starts, and you kind of go do the whole game story post game thing, which for me was it took a while to get adjusted to, because MLB.com does their game stories a lot different than anything I've ever written. I don't know if you've ever read any of those or read a lot of them, but they kind of break it into like a very brief write through of what happened in the game and then moments that mattered and kind of cut it up. It's not your traditional newspaper style game story, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I read a lot of them.
Yeah. And I think the way they do it is really great. And it gives you a lot of information. But basically how it works is you have a 500-word gamer ready as soon as the last pitch is over. And so you file that and that goes online. And then you go into the clubhouse and get the quotes and all that. And then you kind of finagle it to where it's more of a nuanced lead and you get more into in-depth. And then you add in the moments that mattered and the quotes and the stats or whatever section it is, and you kind of spread it out. And so that took me a while to get used to, because, you know, how much information you divulge in the top part where it's just kind of the brief gamer versus, you know, kind of expanding in the moments that matter and stuff like that. It took me a while to balance that. But so far I feel like I'm getting the hang of it, and it's been a lot of fun.
You're covering a team in Cincinnati that's in last place in one of the better divisions in baseball. As we tape this, the Reds are 23-43. They're 16.5 out. They're not technically eliminated, but let's get serious. There's not a chance in hell they're going to the playoffs, and they know it. And yet, and I'm a big NL Central guy. I watch the Cubs night in and night out. So I know about the Brewers. I know about the Reds. I know about the Cardinals, the Pirates, et cetera. I think the Reds thought they were going to be better this year. There seems to be I know they made a managerial change early in the season. They fired Brian Price. They brought in Jim Riggleman. Is there a frustration there that this has not, the rebuild has not made better strides than it has made?
There is 100% a frustration, and you're exactly right. The reason for the managerial change, I think in part, I mean, obviously that they started, I think it was 3-15 And I think part of the pressure to make a move that quickly is because, like you said, there was an expectation this year that they would get, I mean, not contending, but take a step towards contending versus kind of being stuck in the, you know, the middle of the rebuild. I think people thought you were going to see a tangible step forward this year, and that obviously hasn't happened, and definitely didn't happen, and you didn't see that in the season's first month. So, yes, I would say there is definitely a frustration there about what exactly the direction of the franchise is and how they're going to get there.
What is the direction of the franchise from what you – I know you're not covering them. You don't have the spring training to lean back on, for example, or previous seasons. It's not like you're see Trent Rosenkranz and you've been around this team for a decade, basically, where you know it intimately. What is the sense of what's the direction? I mean, they've got all this money tied up in Joey Votto, who is a fantastic baseball player. But, you know, his prime – by the time – if everything works out, it seems like by the time they're ready to be a contender – it's a chance that he's going to be past his prime years. There's so much money tied up in his deal. He's got a no trade. I love Eugenio Suarez. I think he's fantastic. He's one of the more underrated players in the game. But I know they've got Senzel coming up, and they like him. There's Tucker Barnhart, others. They've got some nice pieces. It hasn't worked out completely because in large part they just don't have the pitching at all. So what is the plan?
That's where it becomes murky. And I think in part of that is, like you said, they have a lot of – they have obviously Joey Votto, and that contract's kind of an interesting deal. And then you have a lot of money tied up in Homer Bailey, who, you know, obviously has not been what they thought he'd be, you know, when that contract was signed. And so they have a lot of good young hitters. You mentioned Suarez, and then Scooter Gennett is an interesting prospect to – not prospect, but interesting – interesting position there because he's 28. That's a guy that's kind of gotten optioned by a couple teams, and then he had a great year last year and wanted a long-term deal, but the management wanted to see him kind of repeat that, which he's done this year. So do you flip him? Do you keep him? He's 28, especially with Senzel coming up. Senzel's a second baseman, so you know that would conventional wisdom would tell you they'll probably flip Scooter. But like you said, it's been the pitching. The younger pitching hasn't seemed to develop like they thought. They have a couple pretty good arms in the bullpen in Amir Garrett and Michael Lorenzen and Iglesias, the closer, and a couple of those other guys. But the starting pitching in particular really hasn't developed. They just got Anthony DeSclafani back, who's a guy who hadn't pitched in the big league since 2016, I believe. And he's a guy that they think can help them, you know, going forward for a number of years. So, you know, if you spend a lot of money on starting pitching in the winter, you're probably going to have to overpay for it. But that would seem to be the thing that expedites the rebuild process, if that makes sense, because it seems like a lot of the young core in terms of offense is there. But how they address the pitching, I think, will kind of give you a better idea of how much longer this rebuild is going to go on and how much longer it is until you see better results, if that makes any sense at all.
I'm going to be there in 10 days. I watch them on TV a good bit, mainly because of my just love affair for Tom Brenneman. I watch them on TV, and some of their crowds at home are not good. I know the Cardinals were there over the weekend. What were the crowds like for one of the marquee series? Was it noticeably down?
One of these days this weekend, I think it was the Saturday game, I want to say, was the biggest crowd I believe they've had since opening day. They had 30-something thousand. Don't quote me on that,
oh, wow.
But I want to say that was for one of those games. But there was a lot of Cardinals fans there. And it's kind of the same way that when the Cubs are in town, there's a lot of blue in the stand. So it was bigger crowds, but that was aided by the fact by who they were playing. I mean, there was a lot of Cardinals fans there. I think you kind of see more of the smaller crowds and the declining interest a little bit when it's the Pittsburghs or the Colorados and teams like that coming in, where you don't have a more of a regional fan base close by. But the crowds this weekend were actually really good all 3 days, I would say, all things considered.
You saw the Cardinals over the weekend. As we tape this, they're only three games out. Jordan Hicks is incredible. I know you wrote a story about him, and the Cardinals are obviously watching his workload. They don't want to get him hurt. They don't want to burn him out. They want to have him to have something left in the tank late in the season where he can really be a weapon. What did you hear about him specifically, and how the Cardinals feel about his future? Because, man, his stuff is just electric.
It really is. It is. I mean, it was amazing to watch him go through the order in the ninth there, where he, you know, Votto gets a one out single on something he left up, but then he mows down Suarez and Jeanette to end the game, and he's going 103 mile an hour fastball, and then he'll throw an 87 mile an hour slider the next pitch. I mean, it is incredible to watch. So I was on the St. Louis beat all by myself for the 3 days, which was really interesting. And so it seems like obviously they're going to be careful with him. He apparently is one of the better guys about being open with them in terms of him getting to the ballpark one day and saying, I don't feel right, I can't go, or I feel good, I can go. He's usually pretty open and honest about that. I'm far from an expert on the Cardinals, but you kind of got the sense that he might slide into a closer role in the not so near future, depending on what happens with Bud Norris. But I think he's definitely the closer of the future, but I think it could happen quicker than you think. I don't know. What are your thoughts kind of on St. Louis? Because they're an interesting team to me in that division, because Milwaukee's better than last year, and they took the Cubs basically to the finish. But when St. Louis kind of gets healthy, do you see that as a three-horse race, through and through?
I think it's got a chance to be, and here's why. I mean, it's interesting. It's Milwaukee and the Cubs play this week. By the time people hear this, the series might be almost over. Regardless, both of those teams are, I think, going to be there for a while. I think the Cubs are obviously their win-loss differential. They're like a plus 85, which is remarkable. It also tells you that they've not been very lucky. Those things typically even out. They've got a chance to go on a run. I think Milwaukee's going to make a deal for a starting pitcher, and they're getting these great performances out of guys like Junior Guerra, and they're going to get Kyle Davies back. Their bullpen's phenomenal. Josh Hader is almost unhittable when he comes in, and they almost use him in sort of an Andrew Miller role. You do wonder, can that be sustained all season? But they're a very good team, and I think St. Louis is the least of those three teams. But I'm interested, do they make a deal? Do they have the prospects to go out and make a deal changer? Can they get involved, for example, on a Jacob deGrom, a Noah Syndergaard? I kind of doubt it. But if they did, that would obviously be a game changer for them. Of those three teams, I think St. Louis has the least margin for error. And I think the Cubs and the Brewers, both their lineups are better than what the Cardinals put out night in, night out. And I think their bullpens are better than what the Cardinals field night in and night out, which kind of goes to what you just said. If you take Hicks out of the setup role and you make him just a closer, yeah, it strengthens them at the end, but it weakens them in the middle. And I don't know how many middle arms they have to be bridged from the rotation to Hicks if you put him in the closer's role. It's a tough call for, Mike Matheny and all of those guys in the Cardinals organization that have to make that decision, because if you make him your closer, you're telling guys like Holland and Norris that you don't believe they can close. And the truth is you're going to ask those guys at some point to close, because you do have to protect his arm, Hicks's arm, for the future.
Yeah. And the middle innings have kind of been their issue already. And so I don't think moving Hicks to the closer role really rectifies that at all. And I know I had to write about Holland. He made two relief appearances in Memphis and didn't let up any runs, but he walked two guys each of the time in the innings that he threw, which Matheny seemed pretty discouraged by that, because control has really been his issue. But yeah, I mean, like you said earlier, I think looking at the division as a whole, I mean, it's still the Cubs, right? I mean, they're still the best roster. You think there's the best team, but it doesn't seem as much of a sure thing as last year, because Milwaukee got better, and then you have St. Louis right there. Like, it seems like they'll be kind of pushed more than they have been. And I know Milwaukee gave them a test last year, but that kind of felt like, okay, when are the Cubs going to pass them by rather than if.
Well, a year ago, the Cubs started so badly. I mean, the Cubs did not get 10 games over 500 a year ago until late August. I mean, people forget that they were under 500 at the All-Star break. Wade Davis was their only All-Star. They were, frankly, not a good team in the first half of the season, and they had to expend a lot of energy in the second half, and they played extremely well, and they're better than that this year. I don't think there's a hangover as much, but they haven't gotten anything out of Yu Darvish. You saw them in Cincinnati not that long ago. They haven't gotten anything out of Darvish. Chatwood's been bad. Their bullpen's been excellent. Bryant is not hitting for the power that they would like to see him hit for. Anthony Rizzo's coming along. Hayward's been better since the concussion. I mean, they're a very good team. They look like a playoff team. If you made me pick who's going to win in the Central, I'd say the Cubs, but I wouldn't bet the house on it. I think Milwaukee's right there with them. And here's what's interesting as we get closer to the deadline. Milwaukee wants to add a starter. The Cubs are one of these teams. The name doesn't go away with Manny Machado. I think it's one of those things where the team that wins the Central might be the one that wins the trade deadline. And I hate being that guy because the trade deadline usually doesn't necessarily result in winning. But for the Cubs last year, they made the Quintana trade early. And without it, they don't win the Central. They made it at the All-Star break, in fact. And it was a game changer for them. It deepened their rotation. It gave them a jolt. And if you're Milwaukee, if you're one of the Brewers, as you approach the deadline, you're going to be looking to the front office to get you a starting pitcher. And if you're the Cubs, it wouldn't surprise me if some of the guys on that team, the Lesters of the world that are now in their fourth, fifth seasons with the Cubs, that they kind of look to the front office and go, okay, well, are you going to give us the tool to get over the hump this year or not? And that's a lot of pressure on front offices. And it's kind of why I want to ask this about the Reds. With Votto, obviously, if Joey Votto went on the trade market, he would be a very attractive piece that you could rebuild. You could get pieces for him. You could get multiple prospects, young players, young arms. He's got a no trade. Is he still, from everything you hear, as adamant about he will not leave Cincinnati as he has been in the past?
I think so. And he kind of had some candid comments on a podcast a month back. That was right before I started. I think it was, I don't want to say the wrong podcast, but I know it was right when they were out in LA. And he had some candid comments about the direction of the franchise and kind of what they're doing. And so, yeah, I would say it's still pretty much the same because I think he wants to be here when they kind of flip it from rebuild to contending again. I think he wants to contend either, you know, one more time in Cincinnati and have one good run. But you mentioned the age and the contract. I think they should listen to just about anybody, in my opinion, when it comes to the deadline. I don't think – I mean, there's a couple younger guys that come into mind, like a Garrett or something like that, that's been really good and not costing you any money. That might be an exception. But I think you pretty much have to listen to anyone at the deadline, don't you, when they're in the position that they're in?
Yeah. Oh, if you're the Reds, you have to listen. But you don't waste a lot of time if you know that he's going to turn it down. At some point, right, you have to go to him and say, we're going to shop a little because we're doing our due diligence. Can we open up a dialogue and have a conversation? And then you don't know what his reaction to that's going to be. What if it's very negative? What if he says, you know, I've been loyal to this organization. Why are you not being loyal to me? And you create a problem where there wasn't one. Yet if you're Cincinnati and you're clearly at best the fourth best team in the division, and frankly you're the fifth best team in the division and it's not all that close, you almost have to explore everything. If you're going to rebuild, you've got to rebuild all the way. It's what's fascinating about their team is that Votto is this charismatic guy that is appears to be pretty good with media. I won't say great, but he's at least entertaining with media. He's incredibly involved in the community. He's a great baseball player. He's an MVP. He's almost a two-time MVP. And yet he doesn't really make sense on that team at this point in its history.
Yeah, and to clarify earlier, I'm still pretty new here, but I haven't gotten any sense that anything has changed as with regards to his desire to be there. I don't think that would have changed too dramatically in the last month either. But yeah, no, I mean it is an interesting. The Reds are in a really interesting position as far as what exactly that future is, and you know how far. I mean, it's kind of hard to tell how far along they are in the rebuild because there's just no. There's very few like tangible results to see. And I think a lot of that is because the starting pitching hasn't developed like they, I mean, if you look at their lineup, I mean, you have the guy leading the National League in RBIs, Scooter, I think is tied with Freeman in average, and then Votto leads the NL in on base percentage. So like you have, I mean, their lineup is Matheny said this on, you know, Saturday or Sunday that, you know, they're a pretty tough lineup to get through, you know, given their record, it doesn't really add up. And I think that's, speaks more to, you know, how how little their pitching has developed.
Yeah, that's what I think too. I mean, sometimes you just get into that Reds bullpen and it's bang bang, and it's kind of you can wipe them off the field pretty quickly in a couple innings. And you know, it's a major league team; they're full of good players. It hasn't worked. And I thought they'd be better this year. I really did. They scared the Cubs a lot late last season in games that I watched. And actually, if I recall correctly, they beat up on the Brewers a lot late in the season because I was cheering for the Reds quite a bit. And I thought they would be better this year. I was surprised that they didn't start off better than they did. One more baseball thing, and then I'm going to ask you a couple Ole Miss football questions, then we'll skate. I appreciate your time very much. There are conflicting reports about what's going on with Shohei Ohtani. I know you're just a baseball fan in general. I use my son as a gauge. He's 11. He's a diehard Cubs fan, and he suddenly has all this Ohtani stuff. He loves Shohei Ohtani. He's so fascinating to watch. And there's conflicting reports about his elbow. Will he be out until 2020? In the event that the reports are true and he's going to need Tommy John and he's going to miss a year and a half, how big of a blow is that just to the game as a whole, that this young, exciting, kind of exotic, for lack of a better word, guy comes over and captivates the imagination and then poof, he's gone?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, it's a guy you haven't seen. I mean, baseball hasn't really seen a guy like this in over a half century. I mean, he draws a lot of comparisons to Babe Ruth, and for a game that's kind of had trouble marketing their stars to some degree. I mean, it's huge. I mean, I make it a point to watch Ohtani when I can. And I wouldn't say I'm a baseball fan, but I'm not watching random games on a random night or something like that. But like, if he's pitching or he's playing and I can see it on a TV, I'd definitely go in to find him. So I think, especially, you know, appealing to the younger generation, like you said, and your son loving him so much, I think it's a gigantic blow. And I hope the reports aren't true, but I mean, it kind of sounds like he's going to be out for quite a while, does it not? What is kind of your gauge on it?
Yeah, it sounds to me like I tend to believe it. I tend to believe that the Angels are just putting this off, desperately hoping that it's not true, that maybe there's a way they can, like, for example, you know, we're going to be in California in July, and the Angels are in town, and Shohei Ohtani bobblehead night is one of the nights that we're actually in Los Angeles. And, you know, we're going to go, my son and I are going to go. And one of the people that we know that's tied in with the Angels organization was like, if he wants to get a bobblehead, this was about 3 weeks ago, if he wants to get a bobblehead, you need to be at the stadium 4 hours early. And I'm like, I'm not doing that for a stupid bobblehead. But it shows you the demand and the demand to see this guy, the people that want to, for lack of a better word, touch him. You know what I mean? They want to see him with their own eyes. And I don't know that baseball has many of those people. I mean, he's on a team with the indisputable best player in all of baseball, Mike Trout. And I don't know how many people show up at the ballpark early, night in and night out, to see Mike Trout or to see Bryce Harper or to see Giancarlo Stanton or Max Scherzer pitch or Carlos Correa and Jose Altuve or Chris Bryant or whatever the case may be, Joey Votto, whoever. The baseball has a lot of great players, but I don't know if they had too many people that sort of had the capacity to transcend the sport. And I think Ohtani did/does, and I'm sure the Angels are just sick. Yet they knew when they signed him that there was some elbow damage in there, and I guess they were hoping that it wouldn't get bad, but it sounds like he re-injured it last week. And if you made me guess from reading the tea leaves, when the Pedro Gomez's of the world report that he's going to need Tommy John, those people typically don't miss like that. He probably needs Tommy John, and the Angels know it.
Exactly, and it's just unfortunate because it's not really like a Strasburg-type situation where there's blame to be passed. I mean, from what I gather, they were cautious with him almost to a fault for a while. I mean, that's kind of what I gather to be the case. It just kind of seems like it's unfortunate that it went down the way it did.
Yeah, it just shows you pitching. I mean, I was telling Chase the other day after we'd finished the podcast, we were talking about Ohtani for just a minute. He's a guy that just – his stuff is so electric that you think, watching it, you think there's no way that's not just putting a tremendous strain on his body, and I guess it does. He's an immense talent. I hope that A, it turns out that he can go, and B, if he has to have the surgery, I hope he comes back stronger than ever, because he's guys like him are good for the game, and you just you want to see them at full strength. It's fun to see. For me, at least, it's kind of fun to see some young people captivated by a guy like him. That makes it fun, you know. I mean, I think you can watch kids like Carson's 11, almost 12, and there's kids like him that are just like that. When he wears his Ohtani stuff, kids know who Ohtani is in Oxford, Mississippi. You know what I mean? I mean, they know exactly who he is, and I think that's cool when a guy transcends his region or transcends his market or whatever, and becomes this guy that everybody wants to see. And so Ohtani's that, and I hope he comes back and fulfills that promise. That would be – it'd be tragic if he doesn't.
If his arm in general, I know it's elbow now, and it just becomes a reoccurring thing, and I'm just guessing, kind of spitballing here, is there a scenario where he just becomes a hitter and whether it's a DH or you stick him somewhere in the field where – you know, he won't be much of a liability. I mean, do you think that's a possibility at any point?
I guess it is, but he's such an elite arm. His stuff is so good. I would have to think that they would at least do the Tommy John and let him recover the right way and come back and see if he can regain his form as a pitcher, because he's a game changer as a pitcher. He's a very good hitter, but, you know, as a hitter, I don't know that he can be the superstar that they are signing him to be if he's, you know, just a DH. He can't throw from the outfield. I mean, there are people that are close to some National League clubs, the Cubs specifically, who believe that had there not been an elbow issue, that he might have signed with the Cubs and played in the outfield, but that it was his belief that the throws from the outfield were going to put too much stress on his arm and aggravate the existing injury, and that was one of the reasons that he chose an American League team.
And so the reports are, if it is Tommy John, you're looking at 2020 more than likely. If it's all true, next year's a wash too. Is that correct?
Yeah.
He's
going to miss at least a year, which gets you into the middle of next season. And most guys need 12 to 18 months. And so with an investment like that, you don't take a risk. You don't run him out there in August of 19 and say, hey, let's see what you got. You just wait, make sure he's completely healthy. And then you hope that he's the same pitcher that he once was. And that's in today's media market, a year and a half out of it, man, you disappear. I mean, you almost have to be reintroduced.
No, that's definitely true. I mean, 18 months in you know, like you said, this day and age with social media and the media market and all that, I mean, it feels like an eternity.
Yeah, it is. Here's what's not an eternity as we wrap up. It's going to – you'll be back in August, back for graduate school and back into your – internship with covering Ole Miss for OleMissSports.com. You do too good of a job, frankly. I wish that you'd chill. I told Antonio Morales. I told Antonio when he left the beat. I enjoyed working with him, but I was glad he was leaving. He made me work sometimes more than I really wanted to work. You recovered all of last season, which was a weird year because of the whole interim thing and the Hugh Freeze debacle in July. How do you expect Matt Luke to be different, if at all, in 2018 than he was last year as the interim coach?
That's an interesting question, and the first thing that kind of popped into my mind is the in-game stuff. Wouldn't you? I mean, I think that's one thing, the situational type stuff, where like his maturation as a coach in fan base and kind of the outside would like to see improve. I mean, wouldn't you agree? I mean, that was kind of one of the main issues. They had a lot of, whether it be the Egg Bowl deal or some of the Arkansas stuff, I think that would be one thing that a lot of people would like to see different. I think Matt would obviously probably agree. I think he's a pretty self-aware guy. I think I think that is something that he would like to be different in, and maybe as a staff then be a little bit better in. Does his role change at all in terms of, I think he's always going to be a player's coach and players love him, and obviously that was well documented how they felt about him. And does his attitude and kind of his demeanor change at all now that there's a sense of permanence to it, if that makes sense? I don't know. What do you kind of think will be the biggest difference in Matt Luke himself going into the year?
I think he's going to be a little more forceful. I think it's now his program. I don't think he's indebted to as many people as he was. I think he can be, frankly, more demanding of his staff, both on and off the field. I think that you're right. His end game and in-game management has to get better. a lot of last year. I think he would admit this were rookie mistakes that, you know, that probably were things that he looks back on and thinks, well, duh, I should have done that better. But in the heat of the moment, it was such a weird year, you know, because he was fighting week after week to keep his job. And it was always, well, they're 2-0. And people were saying, take the interim tag off. And then they lost at Cal. And everybody said, no way, done. And then Alabama killed him. And then they had that weird Auburn game where after the game, they're like, we turned the corner. And people like me were like, come on. You know, I mean, it's disbelievable. And then they played better. And then they had that agonizing Arkansas loss where I thought, that's it, it's over. And kind of everybody moved on. And then they had the big win at Kentucky. And you know, they played okay against A&M. But there wasn't anybody in the stadium. And I left that stadium that night, Brian, going – I remember I wrote it in my 10 Weekend Thoughts thing that next day that Matt Luke had done everything that Ole Miss had asked him to do. He had done a great job covering the media – with the media. He'd been great. He's been very respectful, that I just didn't think he was going to get it, and I didn't, and I was pretty well sourced on that. I just didn't think he was going to get it. And then the state game happens, and 48 hours later, he's the permanent head coach. I don't know that there was ever an opportunity for him to truly put his feet in the ground and sink his teeth into the program and make it his, and now there is. And it's the one thing I really wish I could talk to him about is now that it's finally yours, because last season it was never yours. Now that it's finally yours, how do you plan to approach it? And I don't know that any of us who cover him really know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And one of the things that was interesting about last year is, and I'm sure you got this question all the time too, and I got it from whether it be my friends or just students or whatever, is like, you know, how many wins is it until, you know, whether he has a chance to get the job? And I always never gave people a number because it always felt more nuanced than that. You know, he went 6-6, but it was who he beat and kind of how he kept them alive when, like you said, everyone on earth thought they were just dead after the Arkansas game. And so it seemed like more than the win total, it was more of who he beat and kind of how he handled things. So like you said, he was always great with the media. You know, he was great with the players, and he kind of helped them get back up off the mat more times than people thought.
Yeah. What the other thing that will be interesting, and we won't know this until they get some adversity, is I thought last year the rallying cry so many times was, hey, all we have is each other. We're just inside this room. And that works. And I think that works once every blue moon. You know, it worked last year because it was true. I mean, nobody believed in them, and it felt like the world was out to get them. And you know, they liked Matt because he was so different than his predecessor, and that's not a knock on Freeze. It just is what it is. And yet, now you can't do that. Now you can't go in and play this is us against the world, and no one believes in us, and no one thinks we're going to do this, and everyone thinks we're going to quit, and everyone thinks we're going to fail, because all of those things were true a year ago, but that stuff went out the window the night that he got the permanent job, because that was at least the people who mattered saying, we believe in you, and we're not going to quit on you, and we're with you, and you have support. So you can't say those things to kids anymore. Now you've got to get them motivated else in another way, and that's a unique challenge that he'll face for the first time in his coaching career. And it will be interesting to see how he handles it. And what one of the things that's fascinating to me is that there's a chance in that very first game, because there's going to be so much focus put on that Texas Tech game, if they lose it, there are going to be people after week one of the regular season who go, man, this team's in trouble. And he'll have to really rally fast. And, you know, if they win that game, I think there's a little – breather, because they should beat Southern Illinois. They're going to lose to Alabama. You've got 3 weeks before you play a game that, you know, everybody's pointing to and going, this will be an interesting contest, because the next two are sort of, at least in the eyes of almost everyone, predetermined. You're going to beat Southern Illinois, you're going to lose to Alabama, and then you go from there. So that Texas Tech game is going to be really big in terms of the way it shapes the way that they're perceived externally, which a lot of times bleeds into how a team perceives itself internally.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the game everyone has circled is October 6th against ULM. I mean, I think that's pretty much a slight that they scheduled as homecoming. Don't you think the Warhawks will be going for the neck?
Yeah, they'll be very upset. They really will. They'll be really upset. That's a sign of disrespect. The only thing, and I said this about basketball too, but it applies even in early October. The academic demands, Brian, at ULM are such that by the 1st of October, if you have not begun cramming for your final exams, you won't make it. And that applies to student athletes as well. So I anticipate that Ole Miss will benefit from a mentally fatigued ULM team across the way. But I would encourage everyone who is there to watch that sideline and understand that those are the future leaders of this universe.
But getting back to your point, seriously, that Texas Tech is a huge game.
Oh, I was being serious. No, I'm sorry.
They win it. But if they win the Texas Tech game, like with Alabama and LSU coming in the next 4 weeks, it seems a little more manageable if you have that one under your belt. But it does, like, you know, you lose that and you go 0-1. It does become a little more arduous, and the schedule looks a lot more daunting, you know, heading into week two than it does if you got to win. I think that's, I mean, obviously the first game is always important, but that's a big. Big momentum shift, you would say, the first weekend of the season.
It's a big one, yeah. It's stupid big. It shouldn't mean that much. It shouldn't have the ramifications that it will have in the public eye, but it does, and it's going to be a storyline of the first month of the season, and one that probably Matt and others will have to fight the urge to roll their eyes at. But it is what it is, and if they win it, people are going to say, oh, they got a chance, and if they lose it, a lot of people are going to say, oh, God, they're in deep trouble. And that's not fair, but that is exactly what's going to happen. Well, Brian, I really appreciate the time. I kept you longer than I said I would. Hope you enjoy the rest of your summer there in Cincinnati and enjoy covering the Reds. I hope to see you next weekend sometime, and then obviously look forward to seeing you when you get back to Oxford in August.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun. And yeah, when y'all get up here next week, just holler at me, and I'll come pop by and say hello.
We'll do it. Thanks, buddy. Again, our thanks to Brian for his time today on the podcast. Hope you enjoyed that. Football season will be here before you know it. We'll start turning our attention to football next month. I think you can do it in July and get away with it. Sometimes I think people force it in June. I know that's not a popular opinion sometimes. People build entire year shows around college football and pro football, and I just don't honestly think it works. That's my radio background. Call me crazy. Next week, maybe the week after, we'll talk some NBA draft. The draft's coming up. I know a lot of you are Memphis Grizzlies fans. The Grizzlies have the fourth pick in the draft. And then there's, of course, the summer of LeBron. It's very much NBA watching to see what LeBron James does or doesn't do in free agency, a decision that he could make. Has to tell the Cavaliers, I think by June the 29th, what his intentions are as it pertains to his contract. He's almost certainly going to opt out of his deal and become an unrestricted free agent. And starting at midnight on July 1st, LeBron James has the ability to completely shake up the NBA. I guess Kevin Durant does too, but look for Durant to stay in Golden State. So LeBron James is the guy that impacts the most decisions. Does he go to the Lakers and take Paul George with him, for example? Does he go to Philadelphia? Does he join Chris Paul and James Harden in Houston? All of these things are viable options. Does he stay in Cleveland and demand that the Cavaliers retool that team yet again? I guess that's conceivable. It doesn't look likely, but we'll follow all that. I'll get an NBA guest hopefully on the show maybe early next week, and we can kind of take a preview as to what to expect here in the NBA offseason as the draft nears and free agency follows immediately thereafter. So until then, again, our thanks to Brian Scott Rippey. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to all of our sponsors, and we will talk to you next week. Until then, take care.